The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning and welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. My name is Derva MacDonald and I'll be holding the fort for Brendan for today. He's back with you next week, and what a week it has been. So much for the silly season. It's been incredibly busy. And before I introduce you to my panel on this All-Ireland hurling final day, let me take you through some of this morning's headlines. The finishing line keeps moving. That's the Sunday Independent reporting that the Cabinet is unhappy as a delay is reopening on the cards. It's a piece by political editor Philip Ryan, which says that frustrated cabinet ministers have ramped up pressure on NPHET to greenlight the easing of the remaining COVID-19 restrictions. Maybe the stark warnings over the rise in numbers in the last week have something to do with that. Staying with that topic, the Business Post carries a report that Arts Minister Catherine Martin wants full capacity venues to be opened to vaccinated people from the start of the reopening of the entertainment sector instead of it being phased. It's Airbnb which provides the Business Post lead. Government to crack down on Airbnb hosts with a new raft of rules. The paper says that licences will be required for short-term lets and that the Residential Tenancies Board will take over enforcement of any new laws. The Irish Mail on Sunday has a splash and a big inside feature on the Taoiseach's ratings. It carries an Ireland Thinks poll which says that 54% of the public don't want the Taoiseach to become Taoiseach, which would augur a leadership battle if that is the case. All of the government party leaders are down since the last poll that they carried, apart from Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald, whose rating has not changed. Housing, as ever, is big news across all of the papers. The Land Development Agency, the Sunday Times reports, is to get €300 million to build thousands of new homes over the next couple of years. That plan, it says, is due to go to the Cabinet next week, and it will allow the agency to buy thousands of unactivated planning permissions in towns and cities across the countries. The Sunday Times also carries, as many of the British papers do, that incredible description by Tony Blair of US President Joe Biden's decision to withdraw from Afghanistan as imbecilic. And we'll obviously be covering Afghanistan today following that extraordinary address by Ireland's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Geraldine Byrne-Nason, addressed the women of and girls of Afghanistan directly this weekend. And we'll actually be hearing shortly from Ambassador Byrne-Nason from New York. On to the tabloids. Nature, it seems, is healing. Sometimes it's the little things, because for the first time in 17 months, Pub Spy has returned to the Sunday World, and suitably it's a 4 pints out of 5 for the Oakwood Inn in Edenderry. So welcome back to that little feature. It is the little things. Welcome back, Pub Spy, and well done to the Oakwood Inn. Staying with the Sunday World, it leads with the story of yet another assault. You'll remember that last week we spoke about an assault in the Olympian Jack Woolley with his mum Annette, and this week it is actor Barry Keoghan, who suffered facial injuries after a vicious assault during a night out in Galway. The death of a young groom-to-be hours before his wedding in Limerick provides the lead for the rest of the tabloids, and all of the papers today carry updates of that horrific crash in Ballinasloe which claimed 4 lives and injured others. So then, let's introduce you to the panel. My panel today is Mick Clifford, Special Correspondent for the Irish Examiner, Declan Power, Security and Defence Analyst. And also joining us is Professor Aoife McLysett, Professor in Genetics at Trinity College Dublin and a member of the Independent Scientific Advisory Group. You're all very, very welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Sarah.
Thank you.
I might start with you, Mick. I'm always fascinated by these Cabinet frustrated, you know, with NPHET and all of this kind of alarm, as if they were somehow divorced from the decisions affecting COVID-19 and the restrictions. I'm thinking in particular of the Sunday Independent's lead.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there, Derval. I mean, it does seem, though, that we're entering a new phase. There has been a long time during which the Cabinet could effectively hide behind NPHET advice. Maybe it's a bit harsh to put it that way, but I think that's the way it's being perceived in a lot of the times. And you also have to factor in that on the one occasion that they seem to have deviated considerably from it, which was last Christmas, we had a disastrous outcome. But we're now entering a new phase, and I think that is feeding through to the cabinet. Just to give you a little vignette.
New phase, good phase, bad phase, or uncertain phase?
A phase of living with the virus. I mean, I was out last night in Dublin City Centre for an occasion there, just a bit of grub with a few friends, and I was taken aback. I was very near South William Street. You might recall that's where Tony Houlihan tweeted from there. I don't know, it was there at the beginning of summer. The place was hopping, absolutely hopping. And I'm not saying that in a bad way, but quite obviously that's the way things are, notwithstanding there's still some rise in the infection figures. Today in Croke Park, 40,000 people. Now, I know it's only half full, but this time last year there was nobody there. It's going to be absolutely, completely different atmosphere there. So it would appear that in some ways the public are already adapting to living with the virus, and now it's a question of how we advance down that line. And as we've seen today in the coverage, one of the big issues there, of course, is opening in terms of live entertainment and indoor entertainment and that sort of thing. And you have to say that it's one where the perhaps the government will be under pressure to deviate from NPHET advice as they're going into this phase of things, because it seems very harsh for that section of society to remain fully closed when, as I say, it would seem that most others are changing and learning to live with the virus.
Obviously, the Minister for the Arts and Culture, Catherine Martin, seemed to be banging at the door, Declan Power, to get in and be heard, particularly, and we spoke about it yesterday, the live event sector.
Yeah, I think it's important for her politically to be seen to be banging at the door. You know, the reality of this is we're in the messy phase. It's a little bit like the end of a war with the where we are with the pandemic. You have this ebb and flow, this kind of awkward surges here and there. But in the great scheme of things, what we need to remember is we've moved forward a hell of a lot. We're getting things under more control. As Mick has said there, people are able to have a life now that they didn't have 3-6 months ago. And we need to keep that in mind. As the vaccination programme ramps up into its final stages, I think we're going to, we're entering a period of cautious optimism. And I think while it's unfortunate that the live entertainment sector has been hit so bad, I think maybe just a little bit of patience for another month or 6 weeks. I think coming into Christmas,
twice in the last week alone, we've broken through the 2,000 cases a day.
Exactly,
barrier.
Exactly. So we have to, like, the government have to be mindful of that. They know the kicking they got after Christmas, and if I was in the live entertainment area, I would be planning and thinking towards Christmas. And I think the government, if they were to be able to throw them something, that by September they need to give them some sort of guidance then. And if they get that, that would be something tangible to work towards.
I think we should just call it Christmas, because meaningful Christmas got us into an awful lot
of
trouble.
Indeed,
last time, Aoife McGlaisid, the Sunday Times has an editorial which says, being the best small country in the world in which to be vaccinated should also come with a reward. Ours should be fewer restrictions and being trusted to use our personal judgment and common sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the vaccines have their own intrinsic reward, which is the protection from disease. And that is really brilliant. And they are very, very effective at that. But I mean, as you've just been discussing, our case numbers are really high, the highest they've been since January. And the number of people in hospital with COVID is the highest they've been since then as well. And so it's not that the case numbers are not resulting in hospitalizations and not resulting in people being very sick. And the idea of personal responsibility, I think, just as we're on the eve of schools returning, the idea of personal responsibility for school children is kind of a nonsense. It's absurd. They have no opportunity to exercise personal responsibility. The youngest of them aren't even eligible for vaccination. And the secondary school children have only just started to get their vaccines. Yet they're going to be returning to schools, and we don't have significantly improved mitigation measures in the schools. So we want things to be able to open, but there's been, I think, an obsession with just the vaccine numbers and not all of the other things that we can be doing. So even in the context
of... Can I throw these numbers at you, Aoife? Just Fergal Bowers was just tweeting before we came on air, RT's health correspondent. There are 33 adult ICU beds available in the public hospital system. The number of ICU beds open and staffed is 291, to which Dr. Niamh Nolensi replied, there are about 35 paediatric ICU beds, all in Dublin. Are we still at a risky phase? Like, I mean, on your comfort level from 0 to 10, how do you feel?
Well, I mean, so personally, I've had my vaccine. I'm very happy about that. But I think I'm not happy with them. I feel very uncomfortable about the idea of us returning to school without doing anything to make it sufficient to make it better. And like you say, the metric the government have generally been using is, you know, what can the hospitals take, which is a pretty grim metric when you think about it. It's like, you know, when they're reopening, it's not that things are good, it's that they have space for you in ICU, if you think that through to its conclusion. And, you know, so we're running out of space in ICU. So we're running out of scope to open more things according to the government metrics. And, you know, so we have to be really cautious. And the thing is, we know a lot more now about how this virus is transmitted compared to what we knew a year ago. So we know it's airborne, which means that shared air is a big problem. The Delta variant, we know, is much more infectious. It's infections like chickenpox. And anybody who has children or who has young relatives or can remember themselves when they were young, chickenpox spreads really, really quickly and easily.
And it's something, Aoife, that was picked up by Dr. Luke O'Neill. He was writing in the Sunday Independent today. He was saying, you know, that the American Academy of Pediatrics has said that severe illness due to COVID is uncommon amongst young children, and yet there are worrying figures there. More than 400 children have died of COVID-19 in the US. 2,000 are in hospital, many in intensive care. The big change, Declan Power, seems to be Delta. It's not behaving like Alpha, and it has changed things. And it's interesting because Luke O'Neill kind of goes through what we need to do, particularly around getting kids back to school. And one of the things he said is that CO2 monitors are being provided to schools, and they're important. But we're going to still face battles, aren't we, about mask wearing and antigen testing for schools, which is, you know, potentially fraught because parents are afraid of false positives, false negatives.
Well, it doesn't have to be, I would contend, because I think the first thing is that we need to learn from mistakes of the last year, where I think there was a strong tendency, particularly amongst institutions like schools and indeed colleges, to want to work with a narrative that suited them rather than the reality that was there. So last year, there was a lot of time being spent on schools and colleges thinking about, you know, do we have ventilation, do we have whatever, when the information coming down the road was that you're going to end up closed for most of the year and you need to invest more time and effort into the online situation. That was going to be the reality. Now, we're in a different situation. And I think most parents and most people who are connected to the education process will do whatever it takes, or will want to do whatever it takes, to keep that show on the road. And if it means antigen testing, I think makes complete sense. Whatever adjustments you have to make to keep the rhythm of normal schooling, whether that means shortening class times, regular breaks, doing whatever it takes, being pragmatic, that's what we need. And working with the information that we have, not the information that you'd like.
Yeah, and Mick, just on that whole thing about antigen tests and measures, particularly for schools, few eligible students will have received their second doses, particularly, you know, because obviously it hasn't been approved for under 12s yet, but a lot of kids won't be fully protected against the virus when school starts back.
That definitely is a worry, and antigen testing, I think, is a serious role to play, and any other measures we can take. But this whole idea of living with the virus, like, when are we going to get to a point? Delta is horrendous. Are there going to be other variants? In all likelihood, it's quite possible. Like, at what point do we say that right now we can move to a situation whereby this will be the level of opening up going into the future?
But doesn't that phrase, living with the virus, have a kind of another corollary that it means that some people have to die with it or be very sick with it? Isn't that the tricky balance that phrase means?
It absolutely is. One thing that's very noticeable, I think, in the last month, and I hope I'm not tempting fate here, but despite the growth in the numbers of people in hospital, there has been next to no deaths, which I think is hugely positive thing, and that is one major difference with the level of infections last January. But I'm not suggesting, Daryl, that we need to rush and bring everything back to normal. I'm just saying, at what point do we get there? We're already at close to 80% in terms of over 18s fully vaccinated. Is it going to be the case that we will have to wait until we're 95% plus whatever?
Well, that's it. We're 85% of Irish adults fully vaccinated, more than 75% of everyone over the age of 12. Aoife, the Sunday Times says, whatever level is needed for herd immunity, we are set to gallop past it. But I was really, really struck today by a big piece in the Business Post. Was it Rachel Lavin and Aaron Rogan who were talking? One of the big debating points is the the immunity of the vaccines and how long it stays with us. Is it the case, or is it too early to say that, you know, perhaps anything 6 months after you're double vaccinated, that the efficacy falls? Is that a concern?
I think it's a concern, but it is too early to know. So there are some studies, and Rachel Lavin has, as usual, a really, really good report. She's always really reliable and really digs through the numbers and does great investigation. And, you know, she's referring to a study in Israel where they are looking at people who were vaccinated first and what can they see now about the levels of immunity, and there's some suggestion there might be some waning. But I think we also have to be cautious because there's other potential factors at play. Most countries prioritise their most vulnerable for vaccination first, and those are the people in whom there might be a slightly lower chance of the vaccine actually taking effect in the first place. Some of the things that make them vulnerable can be immune system deficiencies, for example, immunosuppression or something like that. And the vaccine still relies on your immune system. It's educating your immune system. So there can be other things at play there. And it could be simply that high case numbers give the virus that the chance to find those remaining vulnerable individuals. So we don't know that yet. But the whole thing about where do we need to get to with the vaccination in order to achieve herd immunity, that changes with the infectiousness of the virus as well. So that changed with Delta, unfortunately. You know, with Delta being much more infectious makes it much harder to contain and makes the herd immunity threshold higher. And this is where, you know, and, you know, talking about when will the next variant arise, what's going to happen? We do need to think about this as a global problem as well. And we see the idea of offering booster shots somewhat indiscriminately, you know, to everybody, not necessarily based on medical need or not necessarily based on evidence of the impact of that booster shot. The impact of those vaccines could be much better for all of us, even if we're being self-interested, by distributing them globally and getting this under control more globally. And the idea of living with the virus, as you said, Derval, it's dying with the virus for many. But how do we move beyond this? We have to get this under control the same way we've got other infectious diseases under control. And I think measles is a good example. It's a very serious disease, very infectious, but we don't feel in our daily lives the work that's gone into containing that. And that is a virus that's been eliminated from this country. That doesn't mean you never get an outbreak, but it means it doesn't spread uncontrollably when it happens. It's captured again. And that's what we should be aiming for.
Are you concerned, you know, about Nursing Homes Ireland? We're just saying earlier this week that they're looking at a number, I think up to 20 outbreaks in nursing homes. And obviously that would have included many, you know, patients there or residents there who are vulnerable, but who would have been double vaccinated. That cohort deserve to be offered an early booster scheme if it emerges? And I think the Mail has a piece that up to 22 million doses could be offered to Ireland as booster injections.
Yeah, well, I think if we have good evidence that it'll help them. So, for example, I think it's Kingston Mills who mentions the point, or maybe even Killian de Gascon as well, that, you know, some individuals just aren't mounting a good vaccine response. And so giving them another vaccine isn't going to change anything. So it could be that in those nursing homes, the things to do, the best intervention is actually to deal with the air quality, because we know this is airborne. Mm-hmm. And so this is where you could talk about really good ventilation, HEPA filtration, high quality masks. So what we recognise as a medical mask, those kind of paper folding masks that we've seen around, they aren't actually the best quality you can get. There's a higher quality, which are sometimes called N95 or KN95 or FFP2. It's different names for the same thing, but those are filtering particles much better. And so just a bit more awareness on the quality of the mask, the quality of the air, that, you know, so that will come about through ventilation and filtration. And those things could really be significant in those settings.
We're getting a lot of messages on that. Someone says, just back from the Northwest, the pubs are packed. There was little checking of COVID certs. Notes on the table saying, we trust that we are vaccinated. It's a tinderbox COVID for winter. One was talking about UCD's plans to open up its lecture halls. Another says, we need masks for primary children, particularly aged 8 to 13, wearing them as young as 2. In many countries, 6 to 8 is a standard. Why are our children less important? Orla asks, what can parents reasonably ask of a school to make sure their vaccinated child is not put sitting beside an unvaccinated child? And then just finally for now, what's happening with air quality and workspaces? We got an upbeat memo to say we'll be back in the office first thing in September. Upbeat on behalf of management, but it's meaningless to employees. Tom and Westmeath says we've no CO2 monitors. The windows are left open and that's supposed to be grand. It's going to get colder soon and that's not sustainable. We have masks, etc., but it feels uncomfortable and just money making related. Mick, there is a huge spectrum of in terms of the population. And I discuss this with my own friends myself. They see me on maybe on the overcautious side of it, but it's going to be different. This living with COVID is going to be informed about how comfortable the individual feels too.
Absolutely. And one thing it doesn't mean is going back to the way we lived prior to COVID. I mean, the whole idea of masks, for instance, I can't see a scenario anywhere in the near future, and correctly so, that we don't wear masks indoors as we are now. And I mean, these are small things that have to be done just along the way. But it's like, I don't want it to sound harsh when I suggest about living with COVID, but the fact is that it's going to be here. And at what point, if, for example, we're talking about a much higher level in order to get herd immunity, do you get to the levels whereby there is the small vaccine resistance that we have in this country and larger in others?
Haven't the Delta variants, and I believe it's got a couple of siblings as well that I read about earlier this week, hasn't that sort of posed a big challenge to even the concept of herd immunity?
We've had a number of variants as well. We should just to inject a note of optimism. Delta's been the one that has taken most of the publicity because it's been so infectious. Another variant could come along that mightn't be as infectious but might have some other aspect to it. But I think, you know, one thing we need to remember is the Delta variant hit at a time when the vaccination programme in most countries, including ours, hadn't had the depth of effect that it's going to have in the coming months. And so it remains to be seen. I'm optimistic. I think that we'll be able to handle it better. And the UK got hit by Delta. Even though they had more people vaccinated, there was still a lot not vaccinated or only half vaccinated. So I think we're going to learn a lot. And also, the point about boosters that was being made there, we now know that NIAC have allowed that you can mix vaccines, and the data tells us that that is very efficient, that there's a high degree of efficacy. So, you know, I do think that we could have more positive news going forward here. And I think that's the way we have to look at this. When we say living with it, I think maybe it sounds to some people it sounds defeatist, but I think containing it, I think we're going to be better able to contain it in the coming months. And we have to look at it that way.
And one quick thing is I think Aoife's point about in terms of the vaccine going to countries, underdeveloped countries and whatever, I think that is vital, that we really need to keep the eye on that, that we do not focus entirely on how best we organise our own society in
it's
terms of
it's an enormous
of
privilege if we're talking about
absolutely
whether that's or not thing. We're getting boosters.
Exactly.
Well, that's true. But also, Ben, Mick, you're quite right. But rather than just the moving vaccines, I think isn't one of the key things about changing legality about the companies being able to make them in those countries.
Yes.
You know, the patent and that aspect of that's something that we really need to get our shoulders behind the wheel and the European Union do. Because you're absolutely right. The quicker that
the
you see vaccination,
and the big debate in the US,
where the rubber meets the road. And the sooner that gets dealt with, then the sooner the third world gets greater amount of vaccination. And the
less opportunity for variants too.
Exactly. We can contain. Yeah. Then the spread is contained.
All again. Well, listen, stay with us. We're just going to take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back to the programme. Well, and I want to say thank you to the panel for staying with me as I spoke there. Declan Power, Afghanistan. Maybe you'll be less diplomatic in your critique of the US's withdrawal. Interestingly, in the Sunday Times has a piece, Diplomatic Meltdown, as Blair calls Biden retreat imbecilic. The UK now saying, we never put a fixed date on withdrawal, very much saying this is on the US.
Yeah, that's a fair point. What's ironic and what struck me when I read that piece was that it was less widely known outside circles that would have been focusing on international security and geopolitics. But the shoe was on the other foot a decade or less ago, where the US considered the UK to be the unreliable partner and were scathing in a, you know, behind certain levels of closed doors in their criticism of the lack of UK will to prosecute the war at the time in Helmand. At one point, the UK drew down on certain levels of troop numbers and the US sent in the US Marine Corps to bolster them up. It's not a narrative the UK would like to be putting out in public, but there was a time when they were considered to be lacking in bringing the fight to the Taliban. And there was an essence where the ordinary British infantryman wasn't as committed to the fight as his counterpart in the US. They didn't, you know, the US or UK soldiers knew that they were being drawn down. Nobody wanted to be the last man killed in Afghanistan. And it just to counterbalance, not to cast any aspersions in the UK. But the other point, and Ambassador Bernaysen makes a lot of interesting points, the military phase of this is done and dusted, and it has been it has ended as a disaster. It didn't have to end that way. Anybody with a cursory knowledge of these matters would know that. I hope President Biden's presidency will come to better things and have better days. But right now, this is his biggest misstep. It's the biggest US foreign policy
misstep. And yet a lot of support at home, bring the troops home. Like, it's been a 20-year war.
I think that's going to change.
The images that have gone around the world, McClifford, that could or should.
Yeah, most likely. I mean, I have a slightly different view in that, yes, it was disastrous the way it unfolded, but it was inevitable that the US would be leaving. I would suggest that it was also inevitable that they were not going to nation build, and whether or not they had a real intention of doing so. Elaine Byrne has an excellent piece in the Sunday Business Today, Business Post today, about the level of corruption there. And the other issue, unfortunately, obviously I think it is women and girls who are going to bear the brunt of this, but I think we are not going to see the same scenes that we did in the late 90s when the Taliban were in power, for the simple reason that they have copped on in terms of they will do the horrendous dirty work they do as much as they can behind closed doors, rather than put that image out as they did before. And I mean, I think we should also remember that in terms of the US, remember back in 2001 after 9/11, if the Taliban had acquiesced to hand over bin Laden, the US would never have invaded the country. So that shows the kind of interest that they even had in the first place. But the unfortunate thing is that they will continue the way they have done, I would suspect, but they'll be very more strategic in terms of how to go about it. And we shouldn't forget, they are not the only country to treat women in this manner.
No,
you can go to any number, like Saudi Arabia, where they've some oil, etc. Even, to a certain extent, like in Hamas and Gaza, and that's not to minimise any crimes Israel commits against Gaza, but we should face the fact that this goes on elsewhere. And unfortunately, you'd have to think that coming into the future, they'll probably tone down the rhetoric and that, but behind closed doors, the type of regime they want to bring in, it's difficult to see how anybody will.
There is a positive point, though, in all of this, just in what Mick is saying, in that because they're not Saudi Arabia, they don't have oil, what they do need is money. And what has changed since the 90s is that Afghanis have, particularly in the urban centres, have experienced a quality of life.
Christine
Lamb
has a fantastic piece on this. You know, she said they know about Love Island, they know
they
about Peaky Blinders, they've got mobile phones.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if, McLeish, just in the digital age that we are in, you know, and it did strike me, those women who managed to march and they had their mobile phones. Do you think that maybe will offer hope that really, I suppose, the age and the fact that they have had 20 years without the Taliban, more or less, that could be something that the younger population might rise up against it?
I think they're reliant on us keeping our eyes on that part of the world, and we have a tendency to get distracted again quickly and not pay attention to things. And I heard an interview with one woman whose name I can't remember, unfortunately, but she was willing to have her face and her name out, much at risk to herself. And she said, after 20 days, they expect that the world press will no longer be paying attention. And that's when things will really get bad for them, that the Taliban might be putting forward a more acceptable face. But I think we have to, if we really care about this, we have to keep paying attention to it. And I think that's going to be really important. I read a really interesting piece by a guy called Juan Cole, who's a really interesting analyst on this part of the world. He writes it on his own website, Informed Comment or juancole.com. And he was just talking about the fact that, I don't think anybody disagrees that it's been chaotic over the last while, but that there wasn't really an option to stay unless they were willing to mount another war, because the Taliban had this truce as negotiated with Trump over the last while to not kill not attack the American military for the last while. But that if they were going to try and stay, there was going to be another war. There was going to be another surge of troops like they had to do before. So, yeah, it's an awful disaster. And I'm not the one who knows how it could have been managed better, but it doesn't seem staying was an option.
Declan Power, I saw an amazing interview with Rory Stewart, the former Minister for Economic Development in or International Development in the UK, and it was the question of not the fact of the withdrawal, but the how of the withdrawal. Right. You know, the civilian contractors had been removed, the air power, the air cover that had helped kept the Taliban at bay throughout all of those years has been removed. So when you hear people in the US or elsewhere saying, well, it's time for the Afghan population to fight the Taliban on their own, they had nothing to do so.
Absolutely.
With.
It was like ripping a sticking plaster off. And people forget that, you know, for President Biden to say they weren't there to nation build, well, that was one of their avowed objectives. Now, we saw a similar thing happen in Iraq, but it didn't end in disaster because the necessary ingredients were put in there at the right time. And what could have happened in Afghanistan would have been, you mentioned civilian contractors retaining their...
About 16,000 of them.
The key things, the air power, the advisors that were needed for that, that could have created a different dynamic whereby they would have been able to keep the Taliban at bay. But coupled with that was something that hadn't been happening and had been flagged by the EU Special Envoy to Afghanistan back in 2009. And that was the need to nation build in the higher echelons to create a sense of Afghan loyalty amongst the district governors, the generals, because what happened here wasn't a win on the battlefield. It was a win in strategic communications for the Taliban. They literally launched a campaign through the tribal networks of communication to the various generals and governors. Do you want to be on the winning side or the losing side? Do you want to be looked after? And then the ordinary soldiers who were quite well trained and may have been willing, certainly showed their willingness to fight before, they took their cue from the top. So if their leaders weren't telling them to stand and fight, they withered away like the mist. There were no major battles.
The other thing about that, though, Declan, is that the support for the Taliban came from those tribal networks in the most rural areas, the places that were at the furthest reaches from power. And what they saw was the level of corruption that was going on, and they were never going to have any loyalty to any regime in that respect.
True.
And there was a number of so-called efforts by the Americans to intervene and try and cut out the corruption. But
hold on a second.
And that's why
Elaine
Byrne's piece is actually so powerful.
Yeah, Elaine Byrne references that in her piece there.
But just to make a point there, this is very important, and I've experienced it myself. You are not going, if you're going to get into the messy business of conflict resolution or indeed aid or anything, you're dealing with corruption in any part of the third world. So you're never going to cut it out. What you have to do is recognise how endemic it is and the nature of how it's embedded in that society culturally, and then find containment mechanisms and find ways to try and work around. If you go tackling it head on, what you do is you actually create a bulwark of resistance. And I think to an extent the Americans may have done that. They cut out the Afghan government of certain key decisions, and the Afghan government then felt, we've no skin in the game. And then the problem
and President Trump obviously directly liaised with the Taliban, I suppose. Plenty of advance notice in any event, but it has been an incredibly costly war. 2.2 trillion, huge loss of life, particularly for the Afghan community. I want to move on to a topic that had everybody incredibly well exercised yesterday, and it was housing. In both the Sunday Times and in the Sunday Independent, it's kind of a variation on a theme, but more money to build houses.
Yeah, more money to build houses. They're going to give, I think it's next to $300 million to the Land Development Agency. There are issues around how the Land Development Agency is going about its business anyway and the constraints it's operating under. I think what's slightly depressing about it is this is the latest leak from what's going to be the government's housing strategy. Housing for All strategy that they have put back, that was originally supposed to be launched in July. They've now put it back to about 2 weeks' time, and they're drip feeding, running flags up the flagpole or whatever.
Well, that was one of my thoughts. Is this a bit of a flyer? Because it sort of appeared in two different versions.
Yeah.
One is a first-time buyer's boost, Declan, and then the other, obviously, the Sunday Times. So, but aligned to that, I don't know if any of you saw it, there was the Business Post lead, which is on Airbnb, and there's a remarkable piece by Killian Woods and Donal McNamee. Sorry, I'm rattling my paper here. The number of homes currently available to rent on long-term leases in Galway is 48. The number of full homes available as short-term lets in Galway is 51. Like, it's,
right, yeah. It says a lot.
It's a madness, isn't it?
It is complete madness. And that, along with the proliferation of student accommodation and short-term lets that are being built, these seem to be the things, as far as when the financialisation of the market, if you want to call it, these seem to be the elements of it that are giving the greatest returns. There are no constraints on it, and it is a major problem because it is completely deflecting from any effort to really catch up with which is what it's all about, trying to catch up with the building of so many houses that were short.
And, yeah. And can I just come back to that point about student accommodation? I find that hugely ironic, the term, because they're not students as we would know it. I've seen some of the student accommodation. It's aimed at high-end foreign students, maybe coming from outside of EU countries who have a lot of money. It's certainly not going to be of any benefit to the average Joe or Josephine going to college from Ballydehob or whatever else. And the other point that you made there, Derval, about the Airbnbs versus... I think if the government want to try and improve things for the younger people coming back into the cities, be they students or young workers, it has to be about tackling the rental side of things. This business of kind of throwing grant money for people to refurb kind of old shop frontages and aiming that at young first-time buyers is a bit unrealistic, because what they want is a semi-D somewhere in a suburb, or maybe a house that they can turn a key and walk into.
Yes, and I see the Residential Tenancies Board might get the gig for regulating all of that. A licence for short-term lets, that would be interesting to see how that would work in practice. Aoife, any thoughts on the housing short or long-term?
It's clear from everything you're saying and everything's been said over the last while about it. It isn't just a supply problem. You know, there are, as we all know, there are apartments that are empty that are probably in turnkey condition. But the snapping up of these by big vulture funds or the like that own a whole block, and they won't rent them unless they get the high rent, so they'd rather leave them empty. And those kind of problems are... there to be dealt with as well. And I think it's more than just building houses. There's needs to be a more joined up thinking approach there, I think. And there are plenty of people who've made really good suggestions on how this is to be done. And I think that has to be looked at. And the idea of incentivizing developers, it seems they've got plenty of incentives to build. I think it needs to be something else, some other way.
And there has to be. Eva, my favourite, or my kind of standout column for the week is Gene Kerrigan's. He's got a piece on the homeless.
And
he says one consequence of the housing crisis is people sleeping in tents on the streets. The very least we owe to people who've been driven to the edge and at times over it is to refrain from bad-mouthing them. And this is in the context of homelessness and tents being linked to assaults and violence in the street. He takes huge exception, Mick Doyle. He says, how do we get from a serious assault on a young man to blaming a very visible category of homeless people, those sleeping in the tents on the streets of Dublin?
He joins the dots of a number of incidents during the week, and I think he does it expertly. And central to a lot of that was comments from the city manager, Owen Keegan, about tents. And Brenda Powers, a piece, to be fair, saying, you know, the reaction there suggests that he shouldn't have said it. Well, I don't think that's the issue. The issue is Mr. Keegan should be well aware that this is not some kind of a lifestyle choice, that despite the fact that there are a number of beds available in the hostel system, what is keeping people out of them, and this has been shown again and again, is people fear and the various issues around it, and that is at the heart of the problem, not the fact that people are deciding just to pitch tents on the street. And the fact that Mr. Keegan didn't refer to that, I think, was an error in his part. He's perfectly entitled to express his view, and it's a view that some people may share.
And he knew it was going to be that it could be problematic, because he said it wasn't good. But it is that point, isn't it, that for some people, especially even with professionally managed hostels, and even if there's capacity and availability there, that people don't feel safe?
Well, it's also mental health issues. I mean, you cannot talk about homelessness without mental health. I remember over two decades ago, when I was still in the army were tasked to run a number of homeless shelters. And I saw up close, the kinds of people that were coming in were people that were struggling with life. And there needed to be a two-pronged approach. Well, giving them a bed for the night, or even giving them access to housing, they had to have the capacity. Most of them were on the streets, not because they originally didn't have a place to live, because they couldn't be sustained there. their family or whoever else couldn't live with them. They either had a drug problem or they had a severe mental health problem. And that has to be recognised. And these absolutely
need to
be right.
Yeah, none of those services were available. There's a reference that those services
and
are not
available.
And it's
a whole of government approach, a joined up approach. Yeah. And we're too bloody stovepiped in this country, how we respond to things for a small country. We need more of a mingling of the different services in order to hit those problems where they need to be hit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not on homelessness, but it is on joining the dots. Aoife McGlaisett, there was an interesting piece by Julian Marcel, I think, at the back page, is it, of the Sunday Independent, on just this notion, and I think it applies to COVID as well, on how personal responsibility, is what's been relied upon to solve big systemic issues.
Yeah. And I think that, and it's deflecting from what really needs to be done. Yeah, it's an important piece, and it's quoting Michael Mann and his new book, The Climate War, which I read recently. Actually, it's really good, and he's pointing out that the fossil fuel industry and these other vested interests have been just been really masters of the public messaging for decades, and they did enough to cast doubt on climate change for many, many years. And now that there's no possibility to cast doubt, they're instead deflecting where the responsibility lies.
It's something we looked at in huge detail yesterday. Aoife, I'm going to have to cut you off there because it is time to come up for the news. I want to thank Mick Clifford, Declan Power and Professor Aoife McGlaisett.